Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink, technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, new allegations against the man who would be bishop, but not everyone's buying it.
When people are feeling afraid and threatened and desperate, they sometimes do some desperate things that may not be completely truthful. And I think that's really tragic.
And The Economist goes after Italy's Silvio Berlusconi.
We are a pro-capitalist magazine. We feel that the abuse of capitalism by this man brings capitalism a bad name, and we wish to attack him for that.
Also, New York police plan to indict unknown rapists based on DNA.
These stories and more coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. At least 13 people are dead and about 150 injured in what authorities are calling a terrorist bombing in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. From Jakarta, Patricia Noonan reports.
Officials say a car bomb was detonated at the JW Marriott Hotel in central Jakarta shortly after midday local time. Authorities have not yet said who they believe is responsible for the blast. But Indonesia's Vice President, Hamzah Has, says the target may have been American interests in Indonesia. The blast tore apart the hotel lobby and parts of the building next door. The Marriott was the location of recent July 4th celebrations by the U.S. Embassy. It's also the hotel used by the Australian Prime Minister during official visits. Suspicion for the blast has fallen on Jamaat Islamiyah, believed to be the Southeast Asian affiliate of Al-Qaeda. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Noonan in Jakarta.
An American civilian contractor was killed in Iraq today after a remote-controlled bomb went off under his truck in northern Iraq. The U.S. military has not released any details about the victim, other than to say he worked for a subsidiary of the Halliburton Oil Services Company. Vice President Dick Cheney is Halliburton's former CEO. A clergyman set to become the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church is reportedly surprised and dismayed by allegations he inappropriately touched another man and that a group he worked with had website links to pornography sites. A vote by bishops to approve the Reverend Gene Robinson was put off yesterday when the allegations surfaced. The presiding bishop says Robinson agreed with church leaders that a thorough investigation should be conducted before the vote. Mississippi voters are choosing candidates for governor today. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
In what's shaping up to be the most expensive governor's race in Mississippi history, incumbent Governor Ronnie Musgrove is expected to fend off four Democratic challengers in today's primary. For the GOP, former Republican National Committee Chairman Haley Barbour has the advantage over Jackson trial lawyer Mitch Tyner. Both lead candidates are getting help from their national parties. Musgrove is the nation's only Democratic governor up for re-election this year. He's received $1 million from the Democratic Governors Association. The Republican Governors Association has donated $1.5 million to Barbour's campaign. The two have already raised more than $5 million each. The winners of today's primaries will meet in the general election November 4th. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
International aid began flowing into Liberia today, a day after West African peacekeeping troops began arriving. The troops will eventually build to a force of more than 3,200. They are in Liberia to force the end of 14 years of civil rule under the rule of President Charles Taylor. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 30 points to 91.55. The Nasdaq is down 12 to 1701. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, thousands of union workers at Verizon are on the job for a third day without a contract. Negotiations are continuing today with unions representing nearly 80,000 phone operators and technicians. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
Verizon and union officials agree significant progress has been made with the help of federal mediation. But Verizon spokesman Eric Rabe concedes some major issues are still on the table.
Job security, our flexibility to manage the workforce, the cost of health care, all those things have to come together.
Verizon's ability to lay off workers is among the biggest issues as the industry shifts away from local phone service to more wireless and internet customers. The unions represent phone operators and technicians in 13 states from Virginia to Maine and in Washington, D.C. They put off a threatened strike when their three-year contract expired over the weekend. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
A new report says non-manufacturing activity in this country surged in July from the month before. The Institute for Supply Management says its index of the services sector is at 65.1, up from 60.6 in June. That's the biggest hike since the survey was first conducted in July of 1997. Any number above 50 indicates growth. General Electric says it will buy the non-insurance operations of Transamerica Finance. GE says it likes the company's strong customer relationships and reputation in the marketplace. GE will pay Dutch insurance giant Aegon $5.4 billion in cash and assume debt for the Chicago-based operations. The company's main business is arranging loans and financing. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3. The newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
According to a U.S. official, the bombing of the popular Marriott Hotel in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta has the hallmarks of an attack by Jamaah Islamiyah, a group with links to al-Qaeda and to the October 12th Bali nightclub bombings. Today's car bomb killed at least 13 and injured 149, mostly Indonesians. The hotel is adjacent to many embassies and recently hosted the Australian Prime Minister. The explosion comes just 2 days before sentencing was expected in the case of a man accused of planning and carrying out the Bali bombings, and just 4 days after President Megawati Sukarnoputri pledged to fight the terrorist network responsible for a series of bombings in Indonesia. Joining us on the line from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, is Zachary Abuza. He's professor of international relations at Simmons College in Boston. And professor, you were just in Jakarta last week. You met with security officials. What's your sense of whether today's bombing is tied to the ongoing trial?
It's clearly tied to this week. You not only have the verdict for Amrozi, one of the Bali bombers, but the trial of Abu Bakar Bashir is coming up and almost concluded.
What did security officials tell you last week? What were their concerns, if any?
Well, there was a lot of concern over an arrest that took place in the central Java city of Semarang in mid-July. At that arrest, they found a huge cache of weapons, including light arms, but it also included 900 kilograms of potassium chloride, the chemical that was used in the Bali bomb, 160 kilograms of TNT, and some 1,700 detonators. What really alarmed the officials was, two things. The first is, if they found this one cache, who's to say that there wasn't another cell out there with a cache of their own? The second cause for concern was there were some 8 shipments of chemicals and explosives into Jakarta that they knew of, but they could not locate.
This week sees the first of what's going to be a series of trials. Dozens have been arrested in the Bali bombings of last October. What are your thoughts about what's ahead?
Well, I'm expecting with each sentence and conviction that there will be more terrorism. I believe that today's was just the first in a string of attacks.
Yeah. What do those behind the bombings want?
They want to create an Islamic State that is governed by Sharia, in which foreigners do not play a role, that has eliminated the corrupt secular state as they see it.
And Sharia, of course, being Sharia law, Islamic Sharia law. Professor, thank you.
No problem. Nice to talk to you, Robin.
Zachary Abuza, professor of international relations at Simmons College in Boston, speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Just hours before the vote that would have made the Reverend Eugene Robinson the first gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, allegations of inappropriate behavior on Robinson's part have sparked a church investigation and postponed the decision about his future. One allegation involves an alleged incident of inappropriate touching. The other concerns a support group for gay and bisexual teenagers that Robinson helped found in Concord, New Hampshire. Although Robinson has not been associated with the group, called Outright Concord, for the last 5 years, reports surfaced yesterday that the group's website contained a link to pornography. Well, for the latest from the Episcopal Convention in Minneapolis, we turn first to Marisa Helms, who's covering the story for Minneapolis Public Radio. Welcome, Marisa.
Actually, welcome. It's Minnesota Public Radio.
I'm so sorry.
So
you're
right.
Absolutely right. Thanks for correcting that.
Sure.
Can you tell us what's happening at the convention right now?
Well, there's a sense of excitement and suspense among a lot of people here, although people are keeping their opinions pretty much to themselves because it is such a divisive issue. People are sort of on one side or the other if they're talking at all. And when they do talk, they sort of have their statements, and that's what they stick to. Robinson does have really staunch supporters who say, you know, he'll be exonerated from these accusations and allegations. And he's also got his very vocal critics who do not want him to be Bishop of New Hampshire.
Well, do both sides seem to be working the crowd or just kind of talking among themselves?
They are, I think they're talking among themselves. I mean, this is an issue that really has to be decided by the legislative body of the House of Bishops. As you mentioned, it did pass in the House of Deputies. So the other folks who may be attending this conference for various reasons, certainly the church leadership would not be commenting to those people. It's because it is such a divisive issue. But definitely there are certain spokespeople who are speaking to reporters, and there are lots and lots of reporters here. It's an international story, and little informal press conferences sort of happening all over the place.
I can imagine. In the few seconds we have left, Marisa, do you expect a vote before the convention ends? Because this group only gets together once every 3 years. Will we have a resolution by Friday?
People are hoping so, but it's not clear yet if that will be able to happen. The investigation is ongoing. They do hope that it will be concluded and that there can be a vote taken by Friday. But
we'll be watching it as you will, Marisa.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marisa Helms is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. And now joining us on the line is Martha Yeager, a spokesperson for Outright Concord. That's the support group for gay and lesbian teens co-founded by the Reverend Robinson. Among the allegations against Robinson is that the group's website contained a link to pornography. Hi, Martha.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about Outright Concord. What is its mission, and what has been the Reverend Robinson's connection to the group?
Concord Outright was one of several outrights that have been founded in the Northeast that are support groups for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and questioning youth. These are kids who are often significantly harassed at school. They may be not being well received at home, or they're afraid to tell their families about who they think they may be, and are at serious risk for both acting out behavior and of suicide and depression. The initial founder was really Betsy Janeway. Reverend Robinson was one of the people who responded to her call to help create an organization to meet that need. And he responded to a need, and when that need was being met and there was a secure organization in place, he moved on to other things. He has not been involved with the organization since 1998.
What did you find, Martha, when you looked into these allegations, particularly about a link to pornography on your website?
The outright.org site did not have a direct link to pornography. It had a listing of the other outrights, of which Concord Outright was one of them, and it had a listing of resources. And if you followed two or three more links, you could get a site that was for adults only.
And you had no idea that was there?
We had no idea it was there.
Was the Reverend Robinson involved in any way in setting up these links?
Absolutely not. He has had absolutely nothing to do with it.
Well, what do you make of these allegations?
When people are feeling afraid and threatened and desperate, they sometimes do some desperate things that may not be completely truthful. And I think there was a desperate attempt after the vote in the House of Deputies that approved his election. And I think that's really tragic.
Martha, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martha Yeager is a spokesperson for Outright Concord.
Italy's Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, is the country's richest man, and he's been accused of getting there through bribes, manipulation of the country's courts, and a stranglehold on most of Italy's newspapers and television stations. Berlusconi's been prosecuted for corruption 3 times and gotten off on appeal 3 times. He dodged a latest accusation that he bribed a judge when the Italian parliament passed a law which granted him temporary immunity. So, The Economist magazine published an open letter to Berlusconi asking him to respond to their evidence of his misdeeds. Joining us on the line from London is Bill Emmett. He's editor-in-chief of The Economist and the author of the letter. And Bill, this is the second time The Economist has taken on the prime minister. Why?
Well, we have gone after prime ministers and presidents before. Many Democrats will remember that we suggested that Bill Clinton should just go. We said he should resign. We've attacked the Russian president, Boris Yeltsin. Now we're attacking the Italian prime minister. We're attacking him particularly because not only has he abused his position as prime minister and he has broken the law in the past, but also because he's a symbol of, we think, the misuse of capitalism and the misuse of democracy by a capitalist.
If you could, please just tick off briefly some of your charges against him.
He has built his companies through false accounting. He has built them through bribing of judges and politicians. He bribed a prime minister in the 1980s to grant the decrees to allow him to build a national television network. And since he's been pursued by magistrates for all of those abuses, he has used now his political position as prime minister to defeat those magistrates in trying to bring him to justice.
And, of course, these are charges, and he's not been tried for any of them, as you point out. But the Italian people, in many cases, really embrace him for his rise to riches story. You know, it's legendary. He had many apartment buildings, and he put cable TV in the apartment buildings, and from there he went on to become a television giant. Why not leave this to the Italian people?
Well, we are leaving it to the Italian people. The Italian people voted him into government, or rather some of the Italian people did, and they will take the decision later. The Economist in Italy, just as in Britain or in the United States, is part of the political debate, which helps the Italian people to make up their minds for or against whatever it is we say.
There's been much controversy as well about Mr. Berlusconi's comments, both about the Germans. He compared a German official to a Nazi concentration camp officer, and his remarks about Islam and Western civilization being superior to Islamic culture. Some have come to his defense. I'm thinking of the Wall Street Journal, Europe, and the National Review, which point out that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. There's a lot right now that's unpleasant about leadership in Europe.
Well, I'm not too worried myself about his jokes or about his own opinions. Indeed, I share some of his opinions, not all of them, and certainly not those about Nazis in Germany, but nevertheless, he's entitled to those. It's his abuses of the judiciary, his abuses of politics, his abuses of politics for the furthering of his business interests that I object to.
Yeah. Bill Emmett, what do you really expect to happen here? Were you really hoping that he would respond to your letter, or did you just want to put forth your feelings about him?
We really want to start a debate and to encourage more debate in the Italian press. I doubt very much that he'll respond to the letter, except perhaps by bringing out a lawsuit against us. He's long had the view that he should be immune from criminal prosecution, but he can use the law, the law courts, against publications that criticize him.
Doesn't he already have a lawsuit against you?
Yes, he has one lawsuit against us from 2001, which is grinding slowly through the Italian courts.
Mm. Well, Bill Emmett, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Emmett, editor-in-chief of The Economist, speaking to us from London. For more on his open letter to Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, go to our website, here-now.org.
Just ahead, ethanol added to gasoline may reduce pollution and increase fuel efficiency, but at what cost?
And later in the program, police in New York City launch a new program to indict unknown criminals based only on their DNA.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Do you know what's in your gasoline other than gas? Well, most of us probably have no idea. But an energy bill passed by the Senate last week would double the amount of ethanol that is one of gasoline's additives and also double the tax subsidies that encourage its production. Ethanol comes from corn and is used in fuel to help reduce vehicle emissions. The Senate bill adopts ethanol as a replacement for another gasoline additive known as MBTE, which has been found to contaminate water supplies. The ethanol lobby and politicians from corn-growing states, along with many environmentalists, are big supporters of the new measure, but some critics have attacked the economics of ethanol production. Others question the air quality effects of increased ethanol use. We're joined now by Frank O'Donnell of the Clean Air Trust in Washington, D.C. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Gail. How are you today?
Good, thanks. And also by Brooke Coleman, director of the Renewable Energy Action Project, which backs the use of ethanol. Hello to you, Brooke.
Great, Gail.
Frank, let me start with you. Ethanol is a renewable fuel, comes from corn. Most people think of it as clean burning. What do we know about its effects on air quality?
Gail, there are a number of things we've learned over the years about it. One is that ethanol is really not needed for cleaner burning gasoline. We've become more sophisticated in how we can make gasoline, and we actually don't need it. As you noted, the Senate bill, it's really designed to raise the price of corn in some of the corn-growing states. And a lot of the talk about air quality is really a cover for that. As you may know, northeastern air quality officials have long been concerned that ethanol actually could cause an increase in pollution, in smog, and actually higher prices as well for gasoline. The American Lung Association in New York State has said ethanol use could lead to more air pollution in New York State. Sierra Club is very concerned about the pollution caused at the ethanol factories. So there are a number of reasons to actually be concerned about this whole thing.
All right. Brooke, your turn. Anything wrong with that argument?
There's a couple of things that are important to remember here, and the first is that gasoline regulations are fuel neutral. So that means when you take an ethanol-blended gasoline and an MTBE-blended gasoline, they have to meet all the same air quality standards. In addition, if these claims that the Clean Air Trust is making were true, we wouldn't be having this conversation. California and other states have been trying to substantiate this claim for more than four years. They've done sophisticated modeling tests. They've run actual car tests. In every scenario, ethanol-blended gasoline is superior on an emissions level to non-oxygenated fuel and MTBE-blended fuel. I'm also curious about the claim that we really don't need ethanol. Ethanol reduces carbon monoxide, fine particulates, but perhaps most importantly, it reduces CO2 emissions. Said that using ethanol and gasoline is the single most effective near-term strategy to reducing global warming emissions.
Let me ask you, if you will, Frank, to respond to the global warming aspect of this argument.
Well, there are a lot of studies that get taken out of context. The fact is that studies about whether it costs more energy to make ethanol than it's worth are mixed.
All right. Well, Frank O'Donnell of the Clean Air Trust, thank you so much for talking with us. And Brooke Coleman, why don't you stay on the line now? We're going to bring Keith Ashdown into the conversation. He's with Taxpayers for Common Sense, an organization that is critical of the taxpayer subsidies to the ethanol industry. Welcome, Keith.
Hey, Gail. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So jump right in here. You know, you're an advocate for free markets. Tell us why there should not be a subsidy to the ethanol industry, as there are to so many industries.
You know, in the last month, we've heard that this year and next year, we're going to have record budget deficits. And what we're saying is we've been subsidizing this industry since the 70s. We've given them nearly 30 years to learn to walk on their own feet. And at some point, we have to start cutting back on the generosity that we've given to this industry.
Well, Brooke Coleman, wouldn't a big agribusiness like Archer Daniels Midland be growing corn anyway? I mean, why does ADM, which is this huge company, need a subsidy?
First of all, the Renewable Energy Action Project supports efforts to reduce subsidies, but we are looking at this issue with a broader perspective, and that is you have 4% of a 100-plus billion-gallon gasoline market that is up for grabs, and you have two choices. One is you can use ethanol, and the other is you can use petrochemicals. Ethanol receives about $1 billion in taxpayer subsidies a year, while the oil industry receives anywhere from $11 to $15 billion in taxpayer subsidies, and Central Command spends $43 billion alone on defending Persian Gulf oil. So So while a taxpayer protection organization might look at, oh, well, we need to stop subsidizing farms, we need to stop subsidizing the ethanol industry, we need to stop subsidizing the ADM of this world, generally we agree. But in the real world here, we have to make a real choice about whether or not we want to use more oil at a far higher price tag for American consumers, or whether we want to use a cheaper, better alternative that, oh, by the way, creates jobs and tax revenues for every single state that has been using it over the last two decades.
Keith, just as a guiding principle, doesn't that make sense to use whatever we can that will reduce our dependence?
I agree with Brooke. Eliminate all subsidies to big oil. They're the first that should be on the chopping block. But you still got to look at what benefit do we get from the ethanol subsidy. I don't think it reduces our dependence on foreign oil. I don't think there's much of an environmental benefit. And then thirdly, it's unclear who in the farm economy is getting these benefits. If it's going to small farmers, I would probably support it, but there's never been evidence of that. The big producers are the ones that are getting this. And to me, that just further enhances an already inequitable farm subsidy program that we have in the federal government.
Brooke, we have just a few seconds for you to give us a last word.
Here we have an opportunity to utilize a renewable source of liquid fuels. We have an opportunity to use U.S. grown grains and waste products to integrate into the gasoline pool. It's an opportunity to create jobs. It's an opportunity to create state and federal tax revenue. And it's a far better product than fossil fuels.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for now, gentlemen. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Gail.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brooke Coleman, director of the Renewable Energy Action Project, and Keith Ashdown of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Earlier, we spoke with Frank O'Donnell of the Clean Air Trust in Washington, D.C.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, it's the deadline for candidates who want to be governor of California if the state's voters recalled Gray Davis. Will the Terminator throw his hat in the ring?
Also, we'll visit an old-world fish market on the banks of the Rialto Canal in Venice. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, police in New York City have a plan to get around statute of limitation laws there. They're going to indict rapists before they know their identity, based solely on DNA evidence.
Also, the lead singer of the British band Placebo on recording with David Bowie.
With Bowie in the vocal booth and us as the critical mass, we couldn't resist the temptation to go, oh, David, I think you could do it a little bit better. How about another one?
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Officials say a deadly car bomb explosion at a Marriott hotel outside of Jakarta, Indonesia, was probably the work of a suicide bomber. The blast this morning killed 13 people and wounded nearly 150, including at least two Americans. Reporter Leili Jahari has more.
There was a scene of chaos in front of the building. The glass was shattered all the way through to the 20th floor, and we could see puddles of blood covering the ground for around two blocks around the hotel.
No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but officials suspect an Islamic militant group with ties to al-Qaeda. U.S. military officials say they haven't found any evidence that a biological weapon is behind a rash of severe and sometimes fatal pneumonia cases in Iraq. But they say they're continuing to probe the outbreak. Colonel Robert DeFreitz is with the Office of Army Surgeon General.
In response to this, the Army Surgeon General has chartered two epidemiological consultation teams to study the cases of pneumonia to make sure we do everything possible to avoid new ones and provide the best of care to those who become ill.
Meanwhile, another American has died in Iraq. The military says a civilian contractor was killed today by a remote-controlled bomb attached to his truck. The victim worked for Halliburton, Vice President Dick Cheney's former company. FBI agents have reportedly paid a visit to a Saudi man linked to two of the September 11th hijackers. A U.S. diplomatic source says agents questioned Omar al-Bayoumi this Sunday in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The congressional report says the man became friends with two of the 9/11 hijackers and helped them with rent payments. A spokesman for the Reverend Gene Robinson says the clergyman is dismayed but calm after the vote was postponed to confirm him as Episcopal Church's first openly gay bishop. The postponement came after an email to church leaders alleging that Robinson had improperly touched a Vermont man at a party in 1998. A bishop has been named to lead a probe into the allegations. Federal investigators say proper track maintenance could have prevented a deadly Amtrak derailment in Florida last year. Four people were killed and 36 injured when the Amtrak auto train derailed in April. The National Transportation Safety Board blames poor track maintenance by the track's owners, CSX Corporation. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are down. The Dow is down 34 points at 91.52.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
New York City officials are launching an unprecedented project to identify unknown rapists by their DNA alone and to indict them before the state's 10-year statute of limitations runs out, as they just did in the case of the East Side rapist, who's still at large and is suspected in 16 attacks since 1994. Under the federally funded John Doe Indictment Project, investigators will develop DNA profiles of rapists and charge unnamed John Does for the crimes, so that if and when the suspects turn up, and if victims are willing to charge, they can be arrested and tried. Joining us on the line is Peter Neufeld, who co-founded the Innocence Project, which specializes in using DNA evidence to overturn wrongful convictions. And Peter, the question is, why haven't the police done this before?
Well, in fact, the police have done it before, but not in a systemic way like this. The first prosecutor to do it in the country was a fellow in Milwaukee who did it several years ago and eventually apprehended the person who was indicted just before the statute of limitations ran, and that person was eventually convicted.
Couldn't you have indicted, let's say, fingerprints?
No, you couldn't.
Why?
Well, they just didn't allow it. In a rape case, if you're recovering semen from a rape kit, there is no other explanation for that semen being there other than it was left by the rapist. If you recover fingerprints at a crime scene, You don't know that those fingerprints have anything to do with the commission of the crime.
But part of this is to beat the 10-year statute of limitations. Why not just change the statute of limitations?
Well, the problem with doing away with the statute of limitations is that there are many, many cases, far many more, that don't involve DNA that do. And there are good reasons for having a statute of limitations. Most importantly, you know, memories fade, witnesses disappear, and if you're arrested on some robbery or burglary 15 years later, even though you're innocent, it may be difficult for you to account for your whereabouts on the evening in question.
What about the women involved, the rape victims? For some of them, this is something that's a 9-year-old event. Have you asked any of them how they feel about reliving it all over again?
Well, I mean, a lot of the victims certainly have some difficulty reliving it, but from our own experience, it's more important to get closure. And this is an opportunity to get real closure. So the victims that we've spoken to support this undertaking.
Yeah. And what about the reliability of DNA evidence itself? Most experts agree that it is sound, but mistakes can be made in collecting it and analyzing it, especially in cases that are, you know, that old.
Well, mistakes can be made, but there are two issues really that are relevant to the John Doe indictments. Number one, they have to make sure that it's semen that they're collecting, right, as opposed to other kinds of biological evidence. For instance, you could find a hair at a crime scene, but if the hair had nothing to do with the rape, if it was simply left by some other person or perhaps even left by the rapist, then that would be very misleading. So you have to be very careful what DNA evidence you're actually relying on in a John Doe indictment. It should be semen. It should be semen from a rape kit or at least from a place in the commission of the crime where there is no dispute. There was a case recently in Florida, for instance, where as part of a DNA dragnet, some gentleman named Garcia gave a sample, and of course he was excluded, but then they ran the profile through a database of unsolved crimes and got a hit on a very old rape and arrested him. Unfortunately, it turned out after they contacted the victim that, no, this was someone that she had had consensual sex with, and so the DNA that they had tested was not DNA from the rape, but DNA from a consensual sex partner.
Well, Peter, it'll be interesting to see how this proceeds.
I think so. I think the most important thing here is to use it sparingly and very carefully and cautiously.
Peter, thank you.
Right. Bye-bye.
Peter Neufeld co-founded the Innocence Project at the Cordoza School of Law at Yeshiva University in New York City.
In some parts of the United States, only around 60% of children are being vaccinated, causing some to say it's time to overhaul the entire system. Among other things, a panel from the National Academy of Sciences is calling on the federal government to force health insurance companies to cover the cost of vaccines. The panel also wants subsidies to vaccinate children who don't have health insurance. Well, joining us on the line is Mark Pauley, professor of healthcare systems at the University of Pennsylvania and also one of the 11 members of the Academy of Sciences panel. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
Tell us why you think the entire system needs some big changes.
Well, there are some gaps in coverage of vaccinations, especially for very small children and adults. And as we look into the future, or even into the recent past, new vaccines have been developed and approved by the appropriate federal committee that approves them, but they carry a very high price tag. And so there's a fear that the affordability of vaccines will come into question.
And what kind of diseases are we talking about here?
Well, the primary ones, of course, are the diseases of childhood, measles, mumps, German measles, and some new ones like chickenpox and various forms of influenza. Then for adults, the primary one is the flu and the flu shot, and then there are certain categories of adults at high risk that are also recommended to get other vaccines.
Now, do we know at this point how many of these 40% of children who aren't being vaccinated are not getting vaccinated for reasons of cost?
Well, what we know is that in parts of the country where the availability and ease of getting the vaccination is higher, the percentage that don't get vaccinated can be pushed much lower than that 40%. So that's circumstantial evidence, at least, that it's not a system of beliefs, but it's both the cost and the inconvenience, at least when I did this, it was finding my 2-year-old and dragging him out from under the bed when the time came.
And what's the argument
to the health insurance companies in terms of covering the cost?
This is good for everybody. That's basically the argument. The easiest case to see is something like German measles, say, which for the child is really just an excuse to stay home and play. But for a pregnant woman who has not had German measles, it can cause serious problems. And this kind of what economists call external effect is what we thought makes the strongest case for vaccines and actually helps to indicate the ones that the government ought to pay attention to and the ones that are less important.
And any idea at this point of a price tag for all this?
Well, the current price tag for the set of pediatric vaccines runs around $400. Now, the percentage of children actually getting the full set is fairly high, so in real terms, the extra cost won't amount to much. But by shifting some of it to the federal government, the expenses that you'd pay for in taxes would go up, but the expenses that you pay for in terms of your health insurance premium would go down. I think there is a gap of about 11% of children who have insurance that doesn't cover vaccines, and that's what we're trying to close here.
And so what happens to this report next, and how soon might this be put into effect?
Well, this is fairly dramatic in terms of the proposed changes, because it proposes having the private health insurance system and the private medical care delivery system take the lion's share of the responsibility, whereas the trend has been more for the government to be purchasing the vaccine. So it represents something of a change there. I think the biggest challenge in the short run for the government will be the price tag, even though, as I said, it's mostly shifted. And it will also be a matter of raising consciousness this is something worth doing and a good investment of our money.
Well, Dr. Pauly, thank you so much for being with us.
Okay.
Dr. Mark Pauly is a member of the National Academy of Sciences panel, which is recommending changes to the nation's vaccination system.
Still to come, it's a sugar pill? No, it's a band. We'll meet Placebo.
You're listening to Here and Now.
A recent FBI investigation in Chicago was held up by the All-Star Game. And then agents worked double shifts to finish their work before this week's Chicago White Sox homestand. Why? Well, it's hard enough to get parking at Cellular Park, but it was made even more difficult because the agent's work involved digging up parking lot C, looking for a body. Specifically, the remains of 1960s-era mob enforcer Michael Frank Bones Albergo. Who is Bones Albergo, and why would Bones Bones be under the White Sox stadium anyway? Joining us on the line is Maurice Posley. He's criminal justice reporter for the Chicago Tribune and author of the book Everybody Pays, Two Men, One Murder, and the Price of Truth. Welcome, Maurice.
Thank you for having me.
Well, who is Bones Albergo, and what happened to him?
Bones was a juice loan shark who disappeared in August 1970.
What does that mean, juice?
That means you lend money to people who typically get in over their heads in gambling debts at very high rates of interest, much higher than a bank, but you have a little bit more easier access to it than a bank would.
Yes.
He was about to go on trial, and he had loaned some money to an undercover police officer, and that apparently was the wrong thing to do in Chicago.
Yeah, so the thought is that the mob might be a little leery of him and maybe get rid of him?
That's exactly what's going on here, is that an informant has told authorities that rather than have him perhaps flip into become a government witness, he was killed in a cleaning supplies warehouse and buried under the floor. Of course, at that time, 1970, when he disappeared, U.S. Cellular hadn't been built yet. So that is why the result of the confluence between the dig and the parking lot C.
Ah, so he was under the floorboards, but the floorboards are long gone. Now he's under parking lot C.
That's what it appears.
Well, how are Chicagoans, especially White Sox fans, reacting to this?
They're kind of taking it in stride, really. They're more interested in getting into the park and seeing the game than they are standing around a pile of dirt to see if somebody digs up potentially some bones.
Because this guy's a small player in the annals of Chicago mob fame.
Exactly. When he disappeared, there was hardly a ripple. He was someone that was going to go to trial, so there was some press interest. But he wasn't certainly in the hierarchy of things a big, big player.
Yeah. Remind us, Chicago, the home of?
The home of Harry Ullman, the hitman with perhaps 30 hits to his credit. Big Tuna Accardo, who ran the mob for years, Sam Momo Giancana, who was a terrible, terrible juice loan racketeer. The list could go on and on. The Spilatros, who, of course, are famous for the movie that was made of their demise, Casino.
Right. And not to forget Al Capone.
Well, you know, Al Capone we just kind of take for granted because everybody knows Al Capone, right?
It's like we here in Boston have Paul Revere.
Yes.
By the way, you mentioned Giancana. Isn't he the fellow who was supposed to have had lunch with Jimmy Hoffa shortly before his disappearance?
That is one of those stories that goes around.
Well, keep looking, you know, in the parking lot.
Speaking of a stadium, yes.
Well, Maurice, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Maurice Posley, Chicago Tribune's criminal justice reporter and author of the book Everybody Pays, alluding, of course, to the rumor that Jimmy Hoffa's body is buried under Giant Stadium. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Adjectives abound when it comes to describing the hot British band Placebo. Goth, glam, a gut-wrenching, hard-driven, punk-popping sound. That's This Picture from Placebo's fourth CD, Sleeping with Ghosts. Although the group is not well known in the United States, Placebo is huge in goth and glam circles in Europe. And through the years, one of the band's biggest supporters has been the master of glitter, David Bowie. Think of his Ziggy Stardust days. Well, recently, Brian Molko, the androgynous lead singer of Placebo, spoke to Here and Now producer April Peavy about the band's success, thanks in large part to Bowie.
The Bowie connection was never kind of intentional. It was just kind of a very, very happy and sort of accident, and we were just very lucky at the very beginning of our careers. It was 1996, and Bowie had gotten hold of one of our demos, and Morrissey pulled out of his support slot. So Bowie asked us to fill Morrissey's place. And so we were kind of catapulted from playing to about 300 people in dingy clubs in London to sort of playing arenas in front of 8,000 people. So it was kind of a baptism of fire. Then one day, you know, kind of just got a phone call. He loved the song Without You, I'm Nothing. And of course, when you get that kind of phone call from David Bowie going, I want to sing on it, I've written a harmony, he kind of go, okay. I mean, so we found ourselves in New York with Tony Visconti, who produced a lot of Bowie's albums and a lot of T-Rex as well. And with Bowie in the vocal booth and us sat back there sort of like, as the critical mass, we couldn't resist the temptation to go, oh, David, I think you could do a little bit better. How about another one? You know, kind of thing.
Instant correlation sucks and breeds a pack of lies. I'll take it by your side. Oversaturation curls the skin and tans the hide. I'll take it by your side. Tick tock. Tick tock.
life on the road in the early days. I always hate using cliches, but I have to use one here. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Is it safe to say then that you've mellowed, that life on the road these days is less crazy?
I think the sex, drugs, and rock and roll thing is very particular to all young bands, you know, kind of thing. I mean, musicians, you take a bunch of guys with issues, stick them on a bus, give them lots and lots of attention, screams, and lots of free alcohol, you know, and, you know, it's always going to get messy, you know.
No hesitation, no delay.
The thing is that we're not as young as we used to be, you know, so it kind of takes longer to recover. We don't believe that we're immortal or invincible anymore, you know. And I also think as you spend more time in the business, you become more aware of your responsibility to each other, to the fans, and to people who've sweat, you know, who've invested blood, sweat, and tears into what you do. And so you become more concerned with not letting anybody down as well. So it sort of becomes about quality rather than quantity.
Fans do take you very seriously. They've experienced those days of experimentation along with you. Not with you, but, you know, in that same age group. And it seems like a lot of your fans are growing up with you. And the messages in your songs these days, especially on this new album, Sleeping with Ghosts, are much more serious, much more introspective.
Well, I think it's just probably a reflection of where our lives are, you know, where our heads are at today, you know, and a reflection of the world that we live in as well. The Bitter End was the first single, and that's kind of about the emotion that you feel when you're going through like a pretty nasty breakup, you know, this kind of the anger and the frustration and the betrayal that you feel, and often there's a determination to be the one that comes out at the end of this breakup with the least scars or the least bruises, you know. It's pretty vitriolic, you know. It's kind of I'm determined to not let you hurt me, and it's mixed in with that kind of anger that you feel at that time.
There's an interesting line in the song, the title song, Sleeping with Ghosts. Soulmate, draw your eyes, because soulmates never die. Is that about anyone in particular?
No, not really. It's not about anybody in particular. It's I came across a book by a crackpot American psychiatrist who had this theory that we're all reincarnated in the first place, and that we spend our lives trying to find our soulmate. You know, and if we don't find them in one life, we'll be reincarnated and find another one. Obviously, you know, I didn't really believe him or think that what he was saying was correct, but I just kind of I thought it was a charming idea about how to approach the sometimes cliched and cheesy subject of eternal love.
Hush, it's okay, dry your eyes. Dry your eyes. Soulmate, dry.
place the love story in today's world, basically, against a backdrop, a post 9/11 backdrop, and that's kind of the backdrop, the movie setting, if you will, for these characters to play out their love story, a bit like Love in the Time of Cholera, perhaps. So I just think it's important to sort of write about people today and the emotions. So it's kind of like basically saying, look around at the world, you know, and it's kind of crumbling apart, it seems. And there's a lot of violence and a lot of anger here. And but rest assured that we have each other, you know. And it's about finding solace in somebody that you love in the face of a very, very scary planet.
Damn the government. Damn the killing.
Brian Molko, lead singer of the British group Placebo, speaking to Here Now producer April Peavy, a glam fan herself. For more information on the group and their new CD, Sleeping with Ghosts, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. For the news and these stories here and now.